Hi, this is Jim Hoffman from EMS Solutions. I want to thank you for joining me again for another audio interview session of Authorized Transmissions. Today, I'm going to welcome David Givett as my guest, and David is the owner of The Legal Guardian at thelegalguardian.com and is also a contributing author to EMS1.com. And this session, I'm going to kind of be discussing with David some of the medical legal aspects of EMS. So just bear with me a second. Let's get David on the line with us.
I'm David, here. Good morning. Hi, I'm there. Good morning or good afternoon, wherever you might be.
Yeah, I want to thank you for joining me. I just want to make sure that I say your last name right. Is it Givett? Is that how it's said?
Perfect. That's it.
All right. Great. Dave, before we get started, I would like for anyone that's listening that might not know who you are, or seen any articles or your website, if you could maybe just give a little bit of a background on yourself and how you've been involved in EMS and where you've come to right now in your career.
Absolutely. I became an EMT in 1987. Shortly after, in 1989, I became a paramedic, and I spent about the next 10 years or so running 911 calls in the city of Glendale, California, for the fire department that was BLS only at the time. I moved up in the organization, in the agency, went out on my own in about 1998 or 99 or so, became a consultant where I traveled around the country working with EMS agencies on things like improving performance and improving quality care and communications with the employees. After that, I became the director of operations for the largest ambulance provider in Maryland. And after meeting my wife and having a daughter, we're back in California, where I've graduated from law school and have decided to tackle EMS in a whole different way.
Oh, well, sounds like you've been all over the place for quite a while, so I think you probably bring a lot of inside information with your, with the legal aspect of EMS, and you can probably bring a lot to the field. I've been reading a lot of your articles online, and I thought it would be a great idea to do this session with you, especially since there's a lot of EMS professionals out there that just don't really spend a lot of time with the legal aspects of EMS until they kind of get called into court or have some type of a legal issue, and most of the time by then it's really too late for them to really start considering what they should have done. And to start, I like to kind of talk about chart documentation or PCR documentation and how important it really is to really note, what we do for a patient and also a lot of the, pertinent items that we may not actually have done or that maybe we should have done but we didn't do. And I wonder if you can maybe point out some of the issues that you've experienced or that you've come across that proper documentation might have been able to prevent or, maybe enhanced someone's, position in a particular case.
Absolutely. To begin with, the thing to understand about documentation is that no provider can document in a way that the law would consider proper, unless they've completed a thorough and complete and comprehensive assessment, delivered proper patient care and treatment. So documentation, before anything else, really begins with patient care. I teach that providers should consider that the documentation is a reflection of their skills, rather than a recap of what they did, which most people, most providers do. They jot a few notes and, hey, this is what I did, and they think they're out of there. But there's not too many cases. Well, in doing my research, I found that there's not too many cases where documentation alone really sank the provider. Usually it's the care that sinks the provider, and the documentation is only confirmation of what ends up being their incompetence. I think more often than not, when a provider's skills are called into question, despite the best care in the world, it's the documentation or the lack of documentation or the poor documentation that reflects something else. That's where a lot of heartaches, can really be avoided.
Do you think that a lot of providers that actually, when they document on a PCR, do you think that they, is it common for a lot of them to maybe not document everything that they did? Why do you think they might be leaving things out? Is there some way they can, prevent that, you think?
Sure. Well, the thing is that documentation to a provider is as unique as that particular provider's style. Some people just think that nothing's going to happen to them. So instead of documenting, let's say, for example, a comprehensive chest pain, shortness of breath assessment with treatment, with follow-up on their documentation, you know, they write CPSOB, transported to hospital, and they assume that that's enough. So there's it's a provider by provider problem.
Right. Well, I know you had mentioned that there's really no way that you can really make it so it'll prevent issues. But do you have any tips that you think that might be able to make a person's PCR or make their chart a little more, I guess, legal proof or lawyer proof if they get called into a court for something?
Well, the short answer is no. Because, you know, they lawyers work very hard at making sure that there's no such thing as lawyer proof.
Right.
But I will tell you that any provider, every provider can certainly close the gap on the issues that, you know, a lawyer would want to bring up. You can essentially, with good documentation, hide your soft targets. Here's the thing. Lawyers don't go after what's on the PCR because that's more difficult. They aim for what's missing. So if a provider thinks of the PCR as a kind of fortress, you know, there's gates and walls and moats and guards preventing unwanted intrusion, well, their documentation could be the same way. Their assessment is the wall and, you know, indicated treatment is the gate and proper procedure and follow-up, all of that preventing penetration into them being called into question. And if they do, if the lawyer finally gets in, there's nothing to find because they've done everything properly. So,
yeah.
You know, if you want to stay out of litigation, write the PCR so that any reasonable lawyer will look at it and tell their client, hey, man, you got no case. And, you know, it's for the unreasonable lawyers, there's nothing you can do. They're out there and they're going to get you, or try anyway.
Right. Well, I tell you, I was reading a few of your articles, and I noticed a lot of times you'll put, like, some of the sayings that are often said, you know, in EMS, things like, you know, if you didn't write it, you didn't do it. And a lot of times it surprised me that a lot of these sayings are really true, you know, which is why I guess it's so popular. But there's so many, you know, providers out there that just kind of blow it off as, you know, the instructor's, you know, little quip or, you know, something that's just been said forever. And do you have? I know you mentioned about having a sort of like a fortress and all. Do you know of any kind of a formula or any kind of a checklist that a private provider could use to maybe stay on track when writing the PCR, maybe, you know, getting that fortress in order while they're doing it so they don't maybe miss one of those doors?
You know, well, that's a really, really good question. The short answer is this. You don't need a formula because, you know, if you didn't write it, you didn't do it. You know, cliches like that are not much more than a formula. I think providers need to change the way they think about stuff. They need to change the way they think about what they do. Like, for example, first, I think providers need to remember who they are, or, you know, who they are, who they serve, and why they serve. You know, they serve the patients because at that particular moment in time, they're the only ones who can. They're, you know, I remember when I was in the field, I would lay in bed, you know, at the station at night and just kind of think to myself, hey, if I call 911 right now, I get me. So that really changes your perspective. The next thing providers need to think about on the PCR is it's the only link between the scene of the call and the ER physician who's going to treat the patient like an hour later, or the surgeon who's going to operate on the patient 4 days later, or even the rehab nurse who's going to be working with the patient 4 months later, you know, or worst case scenario, it's the only link between the scene and the detective who's got no other leads to solve a homicide.
Right.
You know, I think finally, if all else fails, you know what, every provider should carry photos of their, you know, their house and their cars and their boats and their toys and whatever else is important to them, and just kind of glance at them while they write so they can have a clear visual reference, you know, reference of what they stand to lose if they cut corners.
Mm.
So, no, the short answer is there's no formula. It's a thought process. It's a way of thinking.
Mm. Well, the service that I work for actually now, they're getting into the tough book type, electronic type, you know, charting. Pen-based, you know, type charting, and I'm wondering, there seems to be a little growing popularity with a lot of the services using the electronic PCRs, and I'm wondering if you think that might start lessening the chance of, you know, leaving out key items, like you said, like building around that fortress. I mean, I noticed just looking at some of the pen-based chart I've been looking at on my service, it seems that the entire software is built around not forgetting anything and and not leaving things out, you know, everything from times to vital signs. And do you think that's going to help, or maybe just leave it the same the way it is as far as documentation?
You know, I think it depends on the software. If you've got software that's loaded with prompts, then I think it could be a good thing because, you know, if you know when you go to fill that out, you have to respond to each one of those prompts. You can't respond to them unless your care is good, unless your assessment is good, unless your treatment is good. So it could be
right.
a good thing. And, you know, on the other hand, if it's just a mirror image of the TCR that they're just typing in on a laptop, then nothing's changed.
Right, right. Yeah, because it's just an electronic picture of what you're already doing, I guess. It's not going to really make that much of a difference. Well, one thing I noticed that a lot of times, you know, EMS professionals kind of see the legal part of EMS as really just common sense. And my question is, why do you think so many, you know, people in the EMS wind up making obvious mistakes and wind up putting themselves in this potential, you know, legal hot water or opening themselves up to that type of scrutiny?
Peer pressure. I think that the first thing that comes to mind is peer pressure. I think when you got your newer, younger providers and they come out of school and they're real excited and they get their first job in the field, you know, whose lead are they following? They're following the lead of the veterans, the guys that have been out there for a long time. And those, you know, those old timers are usually the ones that are assigned to train the rookies. So I think what happens a lot of times is the new providers start following the adopted style of the way that the old timers do things without building a foundation of their own. And so sometimes that's fine. You know, if you get an old timer who's really good and comprehensive and does the right thing all the time, then that's no problem. But I think the problem legally arises when you got the veteran that's kind of old and crusty and burnt out and hates everything and everyone and is that kind of role model. Well, you know, then that's what the newer paramedic or the newer EMT, the newer field provider tends to follow. I think the flip side is, there's another side to it though, and that is that EMS, I mean, if you really think about it, is generally a young person's game, especially on the ambulance, and so with that comes a certain degree
don't remind me.
You know, immaturity, and that leads to all kinds of legal exposures.
Right. Well, that's a really good perspective on the PCRs and the charts and all. I hope some of the people listening will maybe take a few minutes next time to do one of their charts and maybe take a step back and see if what they're writing could, you know, maybe open them up to scrutiny if they were called into court, you know, for that chart. One thing I did want to also talk to you about, I read your recent article on EMS-1 about ALS releasing to BLS crews, and this
right.
is really another subject that really should be common sense. I mean, in your article you had mentioned, you know, a lot of the common sense aspects of, you know, an ALS unit releasing to a BLS unit. But again, it seems to be an issue that can really leave, you know, a provider, especially an ALS provider, open to scrutiny and, you know, potentially land them in some, you know, some serious hot water, even up into, you know, losing their card or suspending their license. And if you can give us some of the primary problems that you see that might arise from an improper releasing of patients, you know, to a lower level provider.
Right, and you know, that's funny that you say that because the first thing that comes to most people's mind, you know, when they think of transfer of care is that you're transferring to a clinically lower medical authority. But legally speaking, I don't think that's always the problem. I think that, you know, transfer of care from ALS to BLS in many circumstances is perfectly fine. The bigger issue, I think, is the reason for the transfer. You know, if an ALS provider performs a complete, thorough assessment, determines, you know, based on the findings and the nature of the call, that it's a BLS patient who requires no ALS care whatsoever, then the transfer is fine. But on the other hand, here's what you run into is when the ALS provider transfers care without doing a full assessment or without consideration for the nature of the call because, you know, he or she is tired or lazy or there's something more exciting going on, you know, you can hear another more interesting call go out, then that
right.
provider essentially assumes responsibility for anything and everything that goes wrong as a result. And he's just, you know, the cavern is wide open for liability for him or her.
Right. Well, I guess when you put that article together, I mean, maybe there seems to be a growing issue in EMS where dispatchers are actually dispatching a lot of, you know, ALS units to non-ALS assignments either because of the call volume or from triaging calls to a higher level just because they can. And I'm wondering if you think maybe this is why, or another reason why Alias Cruz will wind up releasing Tabela's Cruz, more often than not, as far as statistics go, rather than the actual the patient presentation.
That's interesting. I don't know. I personally don't know for sure that they're necessarily releasing TBLS more often than not, but I do know that sending ALS on everything is a growing trend, and, you have lawyers to thank for that. Here's the thing. Is it in court, the reasonableness, of sending an ALS provider a response to a 911 call is one of the standards that's considered in a lawsuit. So if it's reasonable to send an ALS provider and the dispatch agency or the agency doesn't do that, then they've opened themselves up where they simply could have sent, one or both at the same time and avoided
right.
that altogether.
Well, that makes sense. And maybe answer some of my little personal questions I have when I wonder why I'm going on a certain assignment, only to get down and wonder what I'm doing there. I guess, it's like you said, it's, if it's reasonable to send the ALS crew, I guess it does make sense, overall.
Yeah. Now, if there's no ALS available, no problem. But if
right.
I were, if I were arguing against it, I'd vehemently bring up that point.
Mm. Well, one thing I do want to mention about the article is that I was reading some of the feedback on the article on EMS One, and a couple people kind of accused you of being anti-BLS and wanting, the ALS unit to handle all EMS dispatches. So I just want to give you a quick opportunity maybe to clarify your position on that, to kind of rub out any of those, accusations.
Yeah, first of all, and I don't want to sound like a politician, but I know as well as anyone that BLS is without question the foundation of every EMS system in the world. And, I may be many things. You ask my wife, she'll tell you, but I'm definitely not anti-BLS. What I am, though, is a pragmatist, and I'm defense-minded. And the focus of my work is on the defense of EMS providers and agencies, whether it's ALS or BLS, fire, private, third service, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You'll never, ever find me on the plaintiff's side going against an EMS provider, always and only ever in defense. So as a defense-minded pragmatist, I see that improper transfer of care or, certainly dispatching BLS resources where ALS resources are available, it's a difficult situation for me to defend. I see BLS providers, and this is something that I hope they'll think about, is that if a BLS provider accepts care inappropriately accepts ALS care, and they know better, they're just every bit as liable and difficult to defend as anybody else. So,
right.
There's a much, much bigger picture here. And now for the agencies, it's a lot easier to defend an agency who sends available ALS to everything because, you got your cushion right there. I never know.
Right.
I've read your bio before. I've seen you've been in this business a long time, and as well as anybody, any call, you never know which one's going to be the stinger.
Right, exactly. Sure. Well, I one thing I do think it's important to really note is that there's volumes of text on a lot of these topics, and we're not going to cover them in this half an hour interview. But what I would like to do is kind of get your view or some of the highlights on what we as EMS professionals can do to minimize the potential legal issue without getting caught up in all the the jargon that really a lot of times I guess bores a lot of people in the field. And then winds up, in the end, exposing them to a legal problem.
Here's the thing, and one of the reasons, and we might talk later about how and why I came up with my programs, but to answer questions, simple: do the right thing every time, provide the best possible care to every patient, and never take for granted, that what's going on before you prove what's going on, and then document it. And when you're out there and you're working and you're doing your thing, and you see incompetence or inappropriate conduct, deal with it. Deal with it right now. Don't bury your head in the sand because you got, they're your partners or your pals or, there's some secret code among the providers. I'll tell you, I've seen too many times, that burying your head ends up leading to burying a loved one. And, think of it like this. If your partner kills someone because you failed to act, then not only is the blood on your hands, but the liability is in your lap, and it's just not worth it. So without any legalese, that's my advice to everybody.
I think it kind of goes back to a little bit what you said before as far as some of the newer people that are getting into it, you know, just following along with the old, you know, the people that have been doing it for a while, and especially if someone who's, you know, kind of hates it, doesn't want to be really doing it anymore, and they're taking shortcuts, and then you got the new person really who's, you know, putting their neck out because of the, they don't want to offend or upset the more experienced.
Or they're scared, right? I mean, I've heard from a lot of people that I've only been on the job for 6 months and my partner's been on the job for, you know, 22 years, and
right.
I don't know what to do. I don't want to get fired. I'm still on probation. Well,
right.
I mean,
no
one ever said it was going to be easy.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I used to always, I used to tell people when I was new, you know, some of the experienced providers that I wound up working with who would do something a certain way or would tell me that I shouldn't be doing it a certain way, and they've been doing it, you know, for 10 years. And my response is always, well, it doesn't matter how long you've been doing it. It's really the right way or the wrong way.
Right.
You know, it shouldn't matter how long you've been doing it. It's the right way of doing it or the wrong way of doing it. I think that people should probably keep that in mind.
And
know,
that's
like,
the one thing that never changes. That's the
right.
One of the constants is between right and wrong.
Right, exactly. Well, that's, you gave some great, good information there, and some really good tips. I think that people can really take away from some of the, you know, as far as charting and, you know, B list to A list releases and all. The one thing that I do want to talk about is I saw on your website really a powerful resource that you offer. It's some training you offer, and it's an on site training that you actually offer across the United States. And at EMS Solution, I'm always looking for, you know, unique resources like this. And I'd like to give you, you know, maybe a chance to give us an overview on what this on-site training is all about.
Gladly. Like I said, I'm defense-minded. And so the core of my programs, all of my programs, is the defense and protection of EMS providers and agencies. You know, throughout law school, as we would go from subject to subject, I kept seeing new and more frightening examples. I'm not kidding, some seriously frightening examples of just how vulnerable EMS providers, you know, how vulnerable they really are. You know, there's a serious, in EMS training, there's a serious lack of fundamentally conveying the law and how it affects EMS. So I created a variety of education and training programs. I started writing while I was in law school and refining them since I've gotten my degree. You know, like documentation clinics and legal issue and exposure classes, you'd be amazed at how exposed one is, not on a call, not transporting a patient, nowhere near a patient. You know, the exposures are still all over the place, and the things people just never think about because they're never taught to think about it. My programs, I like to say that I help providers develop an understanding and a healthy respect for the legal system, because you're never going to, it's like the ocean, you're never going to beat it. But as long as you respect it, you can work within it and work together and never have a problem. I'll tell you, it's been a couple years now since my programs were developed, and I'll tell you one thing I've learned is this. It's surprising, but EMS and the law, they operate hand in hand. They're very, very similar. The only way a provider can truly protect against legal exposure is to provide the best possible care. And the result is not just protection from the provider and the agency, but look at the big picture. It improves the care of the patient, and improve EMS altogether. So I guess my long answer to your short question is, you know, I have a variety of programs, all of which intended to show providers the big picture so they can improve themselves and the system.
Mm. Well, one thing I thought was exciting about the program, too, is that I think, if I remember right, it's one of the programs, you're actually right along with the agency's crews to get a feel for what they're doing.
Yeah, that's my, you know what, that's my, it's when I go out and I actually do consulting, I'll spend a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, as long as it takes, writing day and night, talking to the crews, talking to the supervisors, talking to the people at the receiving facilities that deal with the crews. And, you know, I'm not out there giving them legal advice. I'm just listening and talking and analyzing and sharing with them ideas about how they might be able to improve and getting a good feel for the system. At the end, I take it all, put it together, and, you know, wrap it all up into one large, or I can break it down so it doesn't matter, but one large customized program that addresses the needs of that agency. Because, you know, EMS might seem the same from coast to coast, but it's different in every single corner of the country that I've seen. They do the same thing a different way.
Yeah, I think that's important, too. It's just what I think that a lot of people could benefit more from that type of personalized, you know, attention rather than just sitting through a PowerPoint presentation and
right.
You know, being told what they've
already
learned.
Which is pretty good, by the way, but you can't be one-on-one.
Right,
because
exactly.
I'll tell you, the crew providers, and I found this personally, they'll ask me questions one-on-one that they would never ask in a group setting because they're afraid of what their peers might think or what for a million different reasons. So, you know, you're right. That one-on-one is, in my opinion, the best way to go.
Well, I think it really sounds like a really beneficial education opportunity for any agency out there that would be interested in doing that. I think I'll get with you later, and I'll actually get a direct link for that page on your website so any listeners can actually go there and get the complete details. I know they can also go directly to the website, thelegalguardian.com, and there's a manual navigation. They can actually get to that information through the main homepage as well. We're just about out of time, but before I end the session, I always like to give any of the guests I talk to a chance to let us know where they might be going or what they're doing, in the near future, where someone might be able to see them or hear them. And I'm wondering if you're going to be at any conferences or any lectures or anything like that where somebody might be able to catch something on you.
I do. I'm spending a lot of my time now doing research, so I'm not out other than doing private presentations and lectures. I will be doing two sessions for an NREMTP refresher program next month at UCLA's Center for Pre-Hospital Care here in L.A. So I'll put a link to that on my site if anybody wants to attend.
Nothing
for me other than more audience faces. I'll do that. I don't know if it's full yet. Before you let me go, though, I do want to say a thing. I doubt that the guests ever take a minute to thank you. I've been looking over what you're doing. I'm listening to your questions now. And, from one lover of EMS to another, let me just say that I really appreciate what you're doing. I think it makes a big difference. So.
No, thank you.
Didn't want to let you go without saying that.
I appreciate it. Well, I tell you, I do encourage everyone to really take the legal aspects of EMS a little more seriously. And I hope that some of these points and things you mentioned today is really going to, encourage people to do that and maybe think about their actions a little bit more and hopefully maybe, avoid anything that they do today to come back and wind up haunting them in the future. I'll let you go, David. I really appreciate it. Thanks again for joining me. And again, legalguardian.com, they can get all this information and a lot more, especially articles and information on your courses and all.
All right, David. My pleasure. And you guys stay safe out there, all right?
All right, David. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Well, that was David Garrett from The Legal Guardian. I want to thank everyone once again for joining me in this audio session. This session will be live by the end of this week, probably Friday, the 10th of October. And you can listen to the session and get all the information as far as links and any other information on The Legal Guardian and David. And again, I appreciate you visiting, and I'll talk to you soon.